This is Jim Inkster, and thank you for joining us for the Thanksgiving Eve production of Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow is producing. Your number is 877-217-5757. Our email address is talk@talklouisiana.org. And today marks the 60th anniversary of the assassination of President John Kennedy in Dallas, Texas. Later in the hour, we will go back 10 years on the 50th anniversary. We visited with Richard Lipsey of Baton Rouge, prominent business person who was Lieutenant Lipsey guarding the president in Washington, D.C. at the time of the assassination and was the guard at the much-discussed autopsy of President Kennedy. Also, Vincent Bugliosi, who died a year and a half later, he was with us on the anniversary, who wrote one of the definitive books. He is one of those who believes that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. We will go back to the archives and hear the discussion with him a decade ago on this date, a date that will live in infamy. November 22nd, 1963 was the date, so exactly six decades ago, the President of the United States was assassinated. Debbie Elliott is with us, and next week she will be the Founders Day luncheon spokesperson, giving an address at the Crown Plaza. And for those who would like to attend, you can go to wrkf.org/events and hear from Debbie, who has been covering American and Southern politics for a generation for NPR. She is a native of Memphis, graduate of the University of Alabama, lives in Orange Beach, and she is joining us today from that city. And good morning to you, Debbie Elliott.
Hey, good morning, Jim. How are you?
It's nice. I'm doing well. It's always nice to hear your distinctive voice. And as I stated, you have covered many events in this region, including Louisiana. You know the terrain well, and it is one of the most fascinating places on the planet. Louisiana, which has now a smaller population than does Alabama, with 1.4% of the American population, certainly generates much more than 1.4% of the news. And that can be said for many. It can be said for many states in the South. What has been your path as far as covering news and getting acquainted with basically all of the Southern states?
Well, you know, I started in local radio at a public radio station in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, when I was in college. And, you know, much like WRKF, you know, local public radio news is just so important to our country. And that's, you know, you can learn things in a classroom studying journalism, you know this, Jim, but actually working in a newsroom is something completely different. So that's how I started. And I noticed there was a big hole in NPR's coverage. NPR had reporters. This was in the early 90s. I had been out of college for a time, was moving to the Orange Beach area, and noticed NPR had a big hole in the Gulf South, I would call it. We had a reporter in North Carolina, we had a couple of reporters in Texas, and we had somebody in Miami. But that left a big, giant hole, and I thought, you know, I think I can fill that hole. And certainly, I've been busy ever since.
Yes, you have. And I have seen you a time or two here in Baton Rouge. And as mentioned, Debbie will be at the Crown Plaza a week from tomorrow, November 30th. And you can reserve tables by going to wrkf.org/events. And Debbie, what are some of the most memorable stories you've covered?
Well, you know, I was looking up some of my stories from Louisiana in the NPR has sort of an internal database. And I searched my name in Louisiana and came up with nearly 400 hits, which just kind of blew my mind. You know, I love the cultural stuff. And certainly Louisiana has a very distinctive culture. So those are sort of the ones I enjoy the most. I covered, for instance, a stell-off in New Orleans, where people were, you know, from the Tennessee Williams play, yelling "Stella" from the balcony in the French, you know, fun stuff like that. I love. I did a story about how chefs were trying to cook nutria and make it palatable in hopes that that would help solve some of the problem of the nutria eating up your swamps. So I love those stories. But I think also the stories that stand out are Louisiana's on the front line of a lot of things, whether it be political change or political power in this country, or whether it be, you know, energy production, climate change. You're the front line of how we're dealing with climate change in America. So Louisiana has a lot to tell the country, right?
Certainly. And Debbie, as mentioned, attended graduate school, University of Alabama, and a great rival of Louisiana State University, and certainly...
Am I allowed to say Roll Tide?
Yeah, certainly, certainly. But LSU, I think, has a grudging respect for Alabama, and of course, resentment that Nick Saban ended up there after first leading LSU to a national championship, and now he's done it six times at the University of Alabama. But I heard someone say...
And we're very thankful for that.
Yes, of course. He's the GOAT. But somebody said people of our vintage, and I think we're probably pretty close in age, but in Alabama, the three rails were Bear Bryant, George Wallace, and Leonard Skinner. And there may be some truth to that.
For real. And, you know, my first job, I worked at the Alabama Radio Network right out of college, which was a commercial radio network that served the whole state, and covered George Wallace's last administration. So that was an interesting way to learn for a Cub reporter. And that's when Democrats had complete control of the South. And the strongest lobbyists in Alabama back then were a gambling magnate and the head of the teachers union. And I would say that politics in Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana have changed a whole lot since those days. You know, I've witnessed Republicans take over the governorships of all of these states and control of the legislatures. You know, it's just happened in Louisiana where Republicans have sealed complete power, right?
Complete. But there may be factions, as there were with Democrats. And in the early 1970s, the South was a Democratic stronghold then. But to put it in perspective, the governors of Georgia, Alabama, and Louisiana at that time were Jimmy Carter, George Wallace, and Edwin Edwards. And they were three different types of Democrats.
Mm-hmm. You know, part of my speech next week is going to be talking about some of the scoundrels I have covered in the South. And certainly some of those characters might show up in my speech. But there are varying levels of scoundrels, right?
Yeah. And there are some scoundrels, as we know, who are more lovable than others. In the South, with its charm, I think many would regard Edwin Edwards as a rogue, but he was our rogue, and he was quick with a quip. And when he died a few years ago at almost 94, I think he was as popular at the time of his death as he had been in his heyday. But along the way, he served 8.5 years in prison. I'll tell you a story. When he was just out of prison, he mentioned that he was in prison at Oakdale, Louisiana, with the former governor of Alabama, Don Siegelman. And, mm-hmm. and Siegelman said, well, what are you in here for? He said, well, I was convicted on 17 counts of fraud and racketeering. He said, what are you in here for, Don? He goes, well, I was convicted of rewarding a campaign contributor with a board seat. And Siegelman mm-hmm. went to prison for that. And here's a guy who in Alabama had been attorney general, lieutenant governor, secretary of state, and governor. And that's mm-hmm. why he went to prison.
Yeah, he. It was Richard Scrushy who was famous for, also went on trial and ended up serving some time for a scandal in his healthcare company. But you know, there were several politicians on my watch who have ended up in jail. Ray Nagin, I covered his trial, the former New Orleans.
Yes.
mayor. I just think it's interesting to watch what happens to people when they get some power, right?
Yes. And, of course, the South, the region, produced a president of the United States who had his brushes with the law, but as hard as they went after him, Bill Clinton was never indicted, and certainly not convicted of anything, but people all around him went to prison. And Edwin Edwards, that was that phenomenon with him for a long time, but ultimately he did get nailed, and he went to his deathbed saying that he was wrongly convicted, and he did have a legitimate case. That the trial was one in which he was convicted with 11 jurors, and that has never happened to my knowledge in a federal case, but he was. And we'll talk with Debbie about what's going on in the American South and the country at large after this timeout. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. If you'd like to get under the wire with Debbie Elliott, 877-217-5757. She can be heard telling stories on NPR from her native South. She covers news and politics and is going to talk about our culture and history in Louisiana and the South at large next Thursday, Crown Plaza, midday, high noon, and she'll be the speaker at the Founders Luncheon, which has become a tradition. And if you'd like to participate as an attend, go to wrkf.org/events. And a reminder that Subaru of Baton Rouge is our signature sponsor. Subaru of Baton Rouge, as in SubaruBR.com. Again, 877-217-5757. Please be concise. We got a few folks waiting to talk with Debbie in our remaining time with her. Jim on airline. Jim, you're on Talk Louisiana. Hello, Jim.
Good morning. How y'all doing today?
Fine.
I am curious. Why are we always so loath to mention the Dixiecrats? We always act like it's a surprise that the Deep South went Republican when it was, you know, all the racist Democrats went to the Republican Party, and lo and behold, the Republicans took over the South.
All right. Well, people like Lester Maddox and George Wallace, Orville Faubus, Strom Thurmond, before he became a Republican, they were all Democrats. Debbie Elliott, Jim has a point that maybe the politics really haven't changed, just the labels have changed. Do you think he has a valid case?
He has a point. You know, labels have changed, but I don't think you can just blanket say that Republicans are racist. I do think that you can make the argument that conservatives move, you know, the old conservative Democrats certainly have moved to the Republican Party. You know, I think I covered Richard Shelby, the Alabama senator, back when he made the switch. He was one of the first to switch over. That's what I would say.
Well, and George Wallace, he was a flawed man, and he changed his tune before he died. And, of course, in 1972, he was almost killed himself in an assassination attempt on May 15th of 72. But I remember him being quoted by Gay Talese, who went to the University of Alabama, as did Debbie, the great writer who covered Wallace for the New York Times. And he was the only New York Times reporter that Wallace would talk with because he had gone to Alabama, and he and George Wallace took a walk on Park Avenue in 1965, and he pointed up and he said, "Gay, you know, there are no black people living in those apartments. You know it, and I know it. And we've got an issue with race all over this country." And Talese, 50 years later, said he didn't tell Wallace that he lived in one of those apartments, and there were no black people in 1965, and there were no black people in 2015. So race is an issue that permeates the South, but it is an American issue, Debbie. It's not just our issue.
It certainly drives politics today in terms of, like, who votes for whom, right? In the southern states that I cover, Democrats, you know, pick up the majority of black votes, and that has become increasingly so. And you know, you could argue that Democrats are having a harder time winning in these states because they're having a harder time putting together the coalitions that they used to among a chunk of white voters and the black vote. And those coalitions are narrowing now.
Yeah, in Louisiana, it used to be that you could win an election with 95% of the black vote as a Democrat and 30 to 35% of the white vote, depending on turnout. And Democrats now can't get 30%. And in Mississippi, they can't get 20%.
Yeah. Brandon Presley just tried to do that, you know, in the governor's race in Mississippi and was not able to pull it off. Even in a state that has, you know, such a large African-American population, you know.
The highest 40%. And it's the case, unfortunately, in which blacks are voting monolithically for Democrats and Republicans are voting almost exclusively for, or whites are voting almost exclusively for Republicans. David in Atlanta. David, good morning.
Good morning. The recent Court of Appeals decision for the 8th District ruled that groups and organizations and individuals can't sue regarding the Voters' Rights Act. That's going to only the attorney general can. So if there's a Republican administration with a Republican attorney general, that's going to open a huge gate in states like Georgia for more voter suppression. And I hope it's not upheld by the Supreme Court.
All right. There are efforts. It is apparent, and this is not a judgment. It's just a reality that there are efforts to suppress votes in some parts of this country. And it smacks of times of old, which were not so pleasant. And Debbie, it's uncertain
and
how this is going.
And you could argue it's about solidifying political power as well, right?
I think that's exclusively what it's about.
When you have control of all of the levers, you try to solidify your hold. I'm not saying it's right, but I'm saying that's what is going on.
Well, in the 12 states, and I count Oklahoma now, of the Southeastern Conference, former President Trump, won those states, every one of them twice, with the exception of Georgia, where he narrowly lost in 2020. And if he runs again, and he's the nominee of the Republican Party, and he carries those states, he starts with 160 electoral votes, just out of the 12 states of the South, meaning he would only need 110 of the remaining 38 states to win, and he's going to win in the Dakotas and Idaho and Wyoming and Montana and Kansas and Nebraska and Alaska and Iowa and probably Ohio. So you add it together, and Trump, despite his flaws, is he's a viable candidate to win the presidency, and it is the South that is his base. We are his base, Debbie Elliott.
Yep, to quote Atlanta outcast, right? The South has something to say, right? For sure. And if you think about not only in terms of national politics, but also national policy. Like, I was looking back at some of the stories I've covered in the states, these states, and the issues, you know, I think Governor Mike Foster of Louisiana was one of the first governors to say, I'm doing away with affirmative action. And what was that, in the 90s? The Alabama legislature was among the first to really tackle the issue of immigration, trying to crack down on the way migrants were treated in the state, ended up getting struck down by federal courts. But you were seeing the seeds of policies that then became national issues that drove presidential elections, right?
Yep. Well, Debbie will have more pearls of wisdom next Thursday, Crown Plaza, Baton Rouge. And you can go to wrkf.org/events and hear her story. And it is a story that is relevant to our times and our region. Thank you so much, Debbie, and I look forward to seeing you next week.
Thanks, Jim. Bye-bye.
Bye. And we're joined now by Lewis Hertham, who's calling in from the great city of Los Angeles, I believe, the Baton Rougean, who went to Tinseltown and made it big and has survived a strike now. And I hope he's back for the holidays. But good morning, Lewis. Nice to hear your voice.
Good morning, Jim. Always a pleasure, and thanks for taking my call. Well, you can imagine why I'm calling today. I would suspect.
Yeah, 60 years ago today, and this has become one of your passions in life, trying to find out what happened on that day at Dealey Plaza 6 decades ago.
That is a fact. And I understand you're going to be playing a couple of the interviews you did before. I'm interested in hearing those again, but I just want to tell people that there are a few programs out now. There's one, I don't know if you've seen it, Jim. It's on Paramount Plus called What the Doctors Saw. Have you heard about this?
I've heard about it. I have not seen it.
I highly recommend it because it was actually started in 10 years ago for the 50th anniversary. And the people that were making the documentary lost their funding. So it wasn't completed. But finally, someone picked up, you know, bought the materials that they had already done and they finished it. So it's 10 years old, but it is seven of the doctors that treated President Kennedy and Park.
Okay, well, hang tight. We're going to continue, Lewis, in just a moment. We'll be back with more Talk Louisiana after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana on the 60th anniversary of the assassination of President Kennedy. All these years later, there are basically three camps. There's the camp that believe Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. That camp believes this. And Richard Lipsey, who guarded the president, will be with us shortly in an encore interview from 10 years ago. And then there's the camp that believes Oswald was part of a conspiracy and did not act alone. And I happen at this point, open to suggestion one way or the other, I believe that was probably the case. And then there those like my friend Lewis Hertham, who has made a passion of exploring all the intricacies of this case, which remains the most unsolved case in American history. It really isn't resolved. Lewis Hertham believes that Oswald was a patsy. And he calls in from Los Angeles, and I'm honored that he did. And I hope when he comes home for the holidays, we'll have him on this show. And every year there are new wrinkles. But every time there's a new president, there's speculation that these files might be unleashed to the American people, and they never are, which means something. I'm not sure what, but for whatever reason, Trump, Biden, and all the others since Kennedy have not released those files. Lewis Hertham, you were in strong gear when we had to go to the break. I want you to be able to finish what you were saying. Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks, Jim. Yeah, I was just going to recommend everyone to, it's on Paramount Plus. If you don't have Paramount Plus, you can actually do a free trial. It's worth watching this show called What the Doctors Saw. So it's seven of the doctors that treated President Kennedy literally seven minutes after he was assassinated, after he was shot. They all saw entry wounds in the neck and in the head with a massive exit wound in the right rear of his head. I mean, massive, like 5 inches in diameter. Blew out most of his brain matter. And this was been covered up. It was covered up in the autopsy. Now, when you listen to these doctors, it's very hard to, and there are 42 attendants, nurses, doctors, and so forth at Parkland that said the same thing. Every single one of them said he had a massive exit wound in the rear of his head. So that doesn't jive with Lee Oswald shooting him from behind. So it's very much worth looking at that. I would also recommend two podcast interviews on Heroes Behind the Headlines. One talks about the amazing evidence found in the Zapruder film, which supports what I just said about what the doctor saw. I'll leave it at that. And then the other one by Christopher Fulton, who wrote the book The Inheritance, and that story is just absolutely stunning. So I believe we're slowly getting there, Jim, because it's bound to happen. As far as the files that have not been released, almost all of those are in regard to Lee Harvey Oswald. They absolutely knew who Lee was, and Lee was sent to Russia. He didn't defect to Russia. He ran the radar for the U-2 spy plane in Natsuki, Japan. I mean, that's a CIA base. You can't discount those sort of things. And anyway, I am of the belief that Lee was involved, but only to be the guy that took the fall. He was right. Exactly what he said.
Well, when you come home for the holidays, let's get together. It's always a highlight.
My pleasure, buddy. Thank you so much for calling,
Lewis, and glad you're listening in Los Angeles, one of the most beautiful places on the planet. And let's go back 10 years. Richard Lipsey, Pride of Baton Rouge, who was born October 7th, 1939, ironically 11 days before Lee Harvey Oswald. Richard grew up in Baton Rouge, Lee Harvey Oswald in New Orleans, and they both have connections to the Kennedy assassination. And Richard, of course, was not involved in the assassination, but he was the guard assigned to President Kennedy in Washington, D.C. And 10 years ago, he took the microphone in this studio and talked about that experience.
I was stationed at Fort Polk, Louisiana, then Camp Polk, and a new general came aboard. The reservists were there, and we came in as the regular army. And when the new general came in, I was fortunate enough to be asked to give him a tour of the post, and I did. Later that evening, he called me over to meet his family and asked me if I would like to be an aide to him. And I really was not sure what the duties of an aide, general's aide, was at the time, but it turned out to be great.
And you go to Washington, and you're, I guess, walking to the White House, and you go right to the Oval Office. Now, I've been to the White House. I've talked to one president, but I've never been in the Oval Office. You were there for your first day on the job.
Well, that's exactly right. We went to meet the chief of staff when we got to Washington, and he told us that, you know, General Wheel's duties, it was very important that General Wheel meet the president. So he sent us to the White House. We walked into the Oval Office, and President Kennedy came from around his desk, shook hands with both General Wheel and myself, and there was a small table and two little settees around it. And the general and President Kennedy sat on each side, and President Kennedy looked at me and said, "Lieutenant, why don't you just sit right there in my rocking chair?" And so, you know, the famous pictures of all of his rocking chairs. So during their very short, about a 20-minute conversation, I rocked in President Kennedy's rocking chair.
At the age of 23. And he was young, too. He was 45. Were you impressed with him?
I was extremely impressed. Like you said earlier, regardless of your political persuasion, the man was very, very smart. He was a very forward thinker. He had vision that our country has not seen in a long time. He knew where we should be going, not where we had been. You know, he was interested in what writers and painters and artists were thinking. He was really a very intelligent person, a speed reader.
Yeah, when you would hand him these documents, I would imagine he looked at them briefly.
When I would go back to his office, which was frequently, to brief him on people coming to the White House, he could go through 60, 70, 80 pages in a couple of minutes at the most and had a perfect photographic memory. He would know everything in that briefing. Amazing man. He really was. He was a perfect specimen. And, of course, I picked him up out with a couple of technicians out of his coffin when we got to the Bethesda Naval Hospital and laid him on the morgue table to do the autopsy. There was not an ounce of fat on him. A very perfect physical specimen.
At 46. And you have noted this was the first dead body you had ever seen.
First dead person I had ever seen. But you get wrapped up in the emotion of the event. It's like, you know, one of the out-of-body experiences. We had a job to do. General Wheel assigned me that from the moment that the president's coffin, the body, arrived in Washington at Andrews Air Force Base, that I was not to leave it and to guard that. And we got it to the hospital, and General Wheel went upstairs with Jackie Kennedy to the presidential suite to really start planning the funeral. I mean, she had already sent word, although that's one of General Wheel's official duties, and we had a book probably 12 inches thick. Remember, President Eisenhower was still alive. Harry Truman was still alive. Both were quite elderly. So we're pretty up to date on what to do in case of a presidential funeral, state funeral. We had no idea, obviously, anything like this would ever happen. But we were prepared, and when we got that body to the hospital, I went in the morgue with it and did not leave it until the autopsy was over, and went back in after we changed clothes, went back in when Gawler's funeral home were there to put the body back together, basically dress the body, embalm him. And so from basically about 7 o'clock that evening with about a 45-minute break until 4 o'clock in the morning, I was in that autopsy room.
Were you the only soldier who witnessed the autopsy?
I was the only soldier that witnessed the entire autopsy, other than the doctors, of course. There were two and many times three doctors in the room. When we first put the body up on the table, the technicians came in and took photographs and x-rays and prepared the body for the autopsy, and I helped them in that part. And then the room was basically sealed. It was not like the JFK movie that Irving Stone did.
Oliver Stone did.
The scene was chaos in the room during the autopsy. There was no chaos in the room. It was quiet, very attentive. The doctors tended to their business. And so it wasn't like the movie at all.
Well, you were standing there. You saw the president. We've seen some of those autopsy photos since. As you say, he was even a handsome man in death and young, 46 years old at the time. You had been with him for a year. I'm sure had met with him probably 100 times or so during the course of that year, became friendly with him, as friendly as a young man who's a soldier serving the president can be. What was your emotion when you saw him in that condition?
The first impression, well, of course, you have to go back to noon that day, 1:30. We picked General Wheel up in the morning real early, 6:30 in the morning. We go to our office. We lived at Fort Myer, Virginia. That's where all the general row is, where all the generals lived. I was in a BOQ right across from the general's home, living in a very nice...
Okay, we do have to take a break, and we will return and hear more about what happened on this date 60 years ago from an interview 10 years ago when we talked with Richard Lipsey and Vincent Bugliosi. Back with more Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to Talk Louisiana. 60 years ago today, President Kennedy was killed in Dallas. Lee Harvey Oswald was named as the assassin. It's still fraught with mystery all these years later. The man who was born in New Orleans in 1939 might very well still be alive if he had not been killed himself 2 days later by Jack Ruby at the police station. Oswald would be 84 years old. But we talked not only with Richard Lipsey, and at some point we'll play the entire interview with him that we conducted 10 years ago on this date. But we also talked with Vincent Bugliosi, a man who I considered a friend. He died shortly after this interview, about a little over a year later. And he, of course, was the guy who put Charlie Manson behind bars. But he wrote a book called Reclaiming History. Good book. And he made the case that Oswald acted alone. As I stated in the opening, I don't believe that. I think Oswald was involved, but there was a conspiracy. But Vincent Bugliosi fervently believed otherwise, and he made the case on this show a few times, but the last time was on the 50th anniversary 10 years ago today.
The two issues are that Oswald killed Kennedy, and number two, did he act alone? Was there a conspiracy involved? Let's talk about the first issue, because when you talk about conspiracy, you're kind of presupposing that Oswald's involved on a lot of the anti-conspiracy arguments. Jim, it's not even humanly possible for him to be innocent. Because of the nature of life, you may have one, two, three, and in extremely rare situations, even four things pointing towards your guilt, even though you're completely innocent. But you're not going to have 53 things. Oswald's rifle, a 6.5 millimeter Mannlicher Carcano rifle, was determined by firearms experts to be the murder weapon. After the shooting in Dealey Plaza, Oswald was the only worker at the Book Depository building who fled the building. 45 minutes later, Oswald shot and killed Officer J.D. Tippett of the Dallas Police Department when Tippett stopped him on the street to question him. A half hour later at the Texas Theater, Oswald resisted arrest by pulling a gun on the arresting officer. When he was interrogated for 12 hours over a three-day period by the Dallas Police Department, Oswald told one lie after another, one provable lie after another, all of which show, of course, an unmistakable consciousness of guilt. Let's also take cognizance of the fact that in life it's virtually impossible to keep a secret. And here, 50 years have gone by, Jim, and not one credible word or syllable has leaked out of a conspiracy. Why? Because there's nothing to leak out. It's all nonsense. Point number two. Let's assume that one of these groups decided to kill the president. I find that proposition prodigiously unlikely, but, you know, anything is possible in life. Oswald would have been one of the very, very last people on the face of this earth they would have gone to do their bidding for them. He was not an expert shot. He had a $12 mail-order rifle, notoriously unreliable, extremely unstable. Jim, here's a guy that defects to the Soviet Union pre-Gorbachev, 1959, even today. Who in the world defects to Russia? He gets over there, desperately wants to become a Soviet citizen. He's an avowed Marxist. He's turned down. And what does he do? Well, he slashes his wrist, tries to commit suicide, ends up in a hospital. Just the type of person, Jim, that the CIA or mob would want to rely upon to commit the biggest murder in American history. Now, you realize, Jim, that I'm being sarcastic, but I'm making a point here. Final point. This is just 3 points among the 32. Again, let's assume that one of these groups decided to kill the president, and for whatever reason, they wanted Oswald to be their hitman. Let's see where that takes us. After Oswald shot Kennedy in Dealey Plaza and left the Book Depository building, if the CIA or mob had Oswald kill Kennedy for them, there would have been a car waiting for him outside the Book Depository building to drive him to his death. You know that would have happened. And yet we know that Oswald was out on the street with $13 in his pocket trying to flag down buses and cabs. And that fact all by itself tells, I think, any sensible person that he acted alone. I mean, even the presidential motorcade route that took the limousine beneath the sixth-floor window in the Book Depository building where Oswald was, that route was not finally determined until November the 18th, 4 days before the assassination. And I would ask you, Jim, what reasonable person would really believe that a conspiracy to assassinate the President of the United States would be hatched within just 4 days of the assassination?
This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Vincent Bugliosi and Richard Lipsey are with us in our final segment this hour discussing what happened on this day in Dealey Plaza, Dallas, Texas, November 22, 1963. One of the more remarkable aspects of the Kennedy assassination is that the evidence, the biggest evidence, is from a man who was a Dallas dressmaker, Abraham Sapruder, and he was interviewed by WFAA in Dallas shortly after the assassination on the night of November 22nd. Here's how Vincent, or how Abraham Sapruder sounded on this date a half century ago.
May I have your name, please, sir?
My name is Abraham Sapruder.
Mr. Sapruder?
Sapruder, yes, sir.
Sapruder. And would you tell us your story, please, sir?
I got out and about a half hour earlier and get into a good spot to shoot some pictures. And I found a spot, one of these concrete blocks that I have down near that park near the underpass. And I got on top there. There was another girl from my office. She was right behind me. And as I was shooting, as the president was coming down from Houston Street making his turn, He was about halfway down there. I had a shot. And he slumped to the side like this. Then I had another shot or two. I couldn't say what it was, one or two. And I saw his head practically open up, all blood and everything. And I kept on shooting. That's about all. I'm just sick again.
I think that pretty well expresses the entire feelings of the whole world.
Amazingly, a Dallas dressmaker is the man who comes up with the biggest piece of evidence on that day in Dallas 50 years ago today.
Yeah, he actually filmed the assassination. There was no audio on it, though, but he filmed the assassination, yeah.
What is that piece of evidence done as far as fueling the conspiracy?
Well, that's very, very sophisticated. It calls for a long discussion. I don't think we have time to get into it, but you can tell from the film that the first shot's about 160, frame 160. Why? Because Connolly turns to his right, the FBI agents, they all turn to the right and they look up, but there's no evidence that anyone was hit at 160. Three shots were fired. The headshot at 313 was 8 seconds after frame 160, and there's no question that he was hit at 313 because you can see the explosion to the president's head at frame 313. But it gets into several sophisticated issues on the single bullet theory, which I examine in great depth in Reclaiming History, but I, because of time limitations, I don't see how we can get into it.
Well, one thing, Vincent, I wanted to impart, and we've got two different emails about this. The president was wearing a back brace. He's obviously hit once. He's trying, it seems, to go down, but he's not able to get down, and the back brace may have cost him his life.
Absolutely. He was injured very severely when his PT boat was cut in half by a Japanese destroyer in Solomon Islands during the Second World War. So he had this very stiff back brace on, and the shot that entered his, which is the second shot that was fired, but was the first shot that hit him, the upper right back, exited the front of his throat, he did not collapse in the seat as Connolly did. Connolly was hit by that same bullet, and he collapsed completely out of the line of fire. Kennedy did not collapse, probably because of the back brace, keeping his head exposed to the line of fire by Oswald in the sixth-floor window. So, as some people have said, the Japanese finally did get Kennedy in Dealey Plaza on November 22nd, 1963.
That was the incomparable Vincent Bugliosi. James and Metairie, let's slide you in before we part company
today.
Well,
thank you, Jim. Well, thank you very much, Jim. Happy Thanksgiving to you and everyone. My question is this to whoever. In 1992, Congress enacted the President JFK Assassination Records Collection, and that it said that the records were to be made public by October 2017. Why has that information not been made public?
I think you make a good point. And as Lewis Hertham said, it almost all of that evidence points to Lee Harvey Oswald, who had this exotic past. And it was thought that Donald Trump, of all people, would unleash it on the American people, and he refused to do so. And so has Joe Biden, and so did Bill Clinton, and go down the line, George Bush, Barack Obama. They have not unleashed evidence, and 2017 was the date. So we really had two presidents who could have done it and refused to do so. So what are they not showing the American people? And that is the question. By the way, there were 15 U.S. presidents alive on that date in 1963, the 12 who came after John Kennedy, and three of whom were still alive, in Dwight Eisenhower, Harry Truman, and Herbert Hoover. But John Kennedy struck down at 46 years old, Pulitzer Prize winner, war hero, fabulously handsome and wealthy and a great American leader, and he was killed by somebody on this date 60 years ago. Thank you for listening. Have a great Thanksgiving. Subaru is our signature sponsor, Subaru Baton Rouge. Until tomorrow, stay tuned.